Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, this is Diana Long, and it's Wednesday afternoon, and apparently we're going to go commercial-free today. We're having some technical difficulties, and that just means that we're going to have more time to talk with our wonderful guest today, Mr. Roman Zabicki. Roman, are you with us?
I am. Hey, Diana, how you doing?
Hi, Roman. Thank you so much for your time today. I'm looking forward to talking with you and finding out more about your wonderful career and how things are going.
Oh, okay.
All right. So we are having some technical difficulties today, and normally we would have some commercials, and but we're not going to do that, so we're going to spend more time talking.
Okay.
So, Roman, I'd like to... Thank you. Thank you. So I like to start out by asking people a little bit about their childhood and what it was like and where they grew up. And did they spend some time, in your case, as a musician as a child? So where did you grow up, Roman?
I grew up on the southwest side of Chicago, 3538 West 60th Street in St. Nicholas of Tallentine Parish. If you're from the south side of Chicago, you always get what parish you're in, you know. We had a big family, 9 kids. There's six girls, three boys. I was the second oldest. Went to St. Nick's and learned how to play the snare drum and bass drum in their orchestra, and that's how I got into music from my grammar school experience with the choir. I was a choir boy and in the orchestra or the band. We would put on performances a couple times a year, and that's where I got my first taste of performing in St. Nick's band. And then and being on the altar, that's kind of like a performance too, you know, in a church.
Yeah.
It's kind of like a big musical production, you know, you got the choir and the altar boys and the stage kind of, you know. So that's where I got introduced to music and the south side
wow.
of Chicago.
I didn't know about that. So how long were you an altar boy? Was that for a year or longer?
Probably I think he started in sixth grade, so sixth, seventh, and eighth grade. I was three years as an altar boy and choir boy probably for seven or eight. No, wait.
Does that mean that you sang also?
Yeah. Yeah, we had a choir, Sister Louis Mary was our choir teacher, and we got to sing harmonies, and we put on performances during the year, you know, Christmas pageants and stuff like that, and singing at church on Sunday, and that's actually where I got my first introduction to music, was in church through the Catholic Church and the choir and the band.
Yeah, a lot of people get in that way. Yeah, cool,
mm-hmm.
Very cool. And then... Now, one of the things I know about you is that you're an excellent carpenter, and when did that come along?
That came along because I was a musician, so I didn't have any steady job kind of thing. A friend of mine was owned a little construction company in Lincoln Park, Old Town Construction, and they were needed guys to demo out buildings, so he would pay us... I think back then it was $5 an hour, which is a lot of money back in the 70s. And we'd go in and strip the walls of plaster and gut everything, and then he would have his carpenters come in and start building. And I was paying attention how they were doing stuff, and one of my friends is a carpenter, and they showed me some stuff. And then he needed somebody to do a tile job, and he said, oh, you should do it, Roman. And I said, I don't know how to tile, so he showed me. And then he said, you know, you should just start your own company, Mr. Z's Handyman Service. And that's where I got my start. Then I just learned things on my own for a few years because I got married and had a kid, and then you need money coming in. You know, it's very important. They want to eat every day, sometimes twice and three times a day. So you got to make sure there's a flow of money coming in. It's really hard to make money as a musician. So I started my own little company, Mr. Z's Handyman Service, for about 10 years, 8 or 10 years. And then my brother-in-law said he could get me in the union as a union carpenter. So I applied and was accepted and started taking classes at the union journeyman an apprentice training center out in Elk Grove Village, and that was great. And I worked for the union for 25 years. Then a few years ago, I couldn't find any work, and I retired. And that's how I got into carpentry. I love it. I love carpentry. It's fun. I like the feeling of doing something constructive. At the end of the day, you look back and you see, well, look at that wall or whatever you did. It's a very satisfying feeling. The pay was good, and I like the camaraderie, guys goofing around with each other all day, cutting the crap out of each other and stuff like that. And but there just wasn't any work, so I retired so I could get a pension. And now it gives me more time for playing music, which is great.
Which brings me kind of to my next question. Now, how long have you been in a band? Were you in a band when you were a kid, when you were like in high school, or what?
Grammar school was the first band I was in. It was called the Continentals. It was in eighth grade, and we played at our St. Nick's talent show. And it was back then. I'm so old. Back then, guitars weren't really popular. They had. It was more like trumpet and sax. Those were the cool instruments and stuff like that. So the lineup of the Continentals was an accordion and a saxophone player, a trumpet, and I played snare drum. That was, I didn't even have a drum. We were too poor with nine kids, so I had to borrow a friend of mine. That was my first band, and we played. Our biggest hit of the day was Never on a Sunday, because that was actually out. But we were doing stuff like Whispering and Satin Doll and stuff like that kind of music. So there was the first band. Then for high school, I went to a seminary, St. Augustine Seminary, studying to be a priest. And that was in Holland, Michigan. So you go away for the 9 months of schooling, come home for Christmas and summer and stuff like that. But I went away to the seminary because I thought I wanted to be a priest. And someone donated a drum set. And we actually had a little band out there called the Scop. And we would, but it was very hard to practice to secure. There was no real practice room. We were practicing in a storage room underneath the chapel, and you couldn't play there at certain hours. There was only like a half an hour or an hour on the weekend when it was okay to make music in that room. So that was kind of limiting, but it did allow me to play a set. You know, that was the first time I had played on a full set of drums, because in the grammar school band, you either played snare drum or bass drum. There wasn't a full trap set, kind of like that. So that was the first time I played a drum set. And then on Sunday nights, we would get to watch TV. The seminary was so structured. They structured everything about your life, what time you got up. Got up at 6, went to church, and went to house jobs, then school, then recreation. And your whole day was structured from 6 till 10 at night. But you could have some free time on the at weekends, and that's when we would try and practice and stuff.
What were the other people?
That's where I was going with the story. I forgot. Sunday nights we could watch television, you know, because you couldn't watch television during the week, but Sunday nights you could watch television. And I remember it was a Sunday night, and we were watching television, and the Beatles come on, and Ed Sullivan, and it blew my mind.
I was going to ask you about the Beatles, and
that changed my life. I thought, that's what I want to do, you know, and so I stayed in the seminary till I graduated from the minor seminary. That's like 4 years of high school. Then you go to a novitiate for a year in Oconomowoc, Wisconsin. And it's like a year of meditation and spiritual reading and manual labor before you take vows. It's to make sure you want to take vows. You know, they're simple vows. They last for 3 years. And it was in that year that I came out and decided I didn't want to be. I was just questioning a lot of things about church, and I didn't believe a lot of it anymore. The Inquisition and stuff like that, you know. Hey, what do we do here? That doesn't sound like a good thing to do, torture and kill people. But anyways, I left the seminary and then started. I bought a drum set when I got out of the seminary and started playing drums in local bands. And I've been playing since I've been like 19, so almost 40 years of playing.
Mm-hmm.
Almost 50 years of playing. Yeah.
So, seeing the Beatles made you want to do what?
Seeing the Beatles?
Seeing the Beatles made
me
want to
play music. I mean, I always liked music. Hello?
I'm here.
Oh, okay. What was it? I think it conked out for a second there.
Okay. Seeing the Beatles made you want to do what? You said it changed your life. In what way?
Yeah.
In what way?
It was so cool. I had never seen anything like that, you know. I mean, I love music. I always liked making music. We go to weddings as a kid, and I always watched the drummer and stuff. I thought it was just great. But when I saw them and how much, it looked like they're having so much fun, and the girls screaming, going wild, you know, their music was very catchy. It wasn't like anything before that. Like, when I was growing up, there were a lot of Bobby Rydell, all these, Bobby Sherman, you know, all these guys that made, like, kind of not very good music. I didn't like them. And the Beatles are really different. And then their hair and the way they dressed, they're just really cool. They were like the epitome of cool. And it changed my life. I mean, I thought, man, that looks like it's a lot of fun. I want to do that. And it also changed my drumming. Ringo Starr, I was taught the traditional grip and holding drumsticks. And Ringo Starr played with a match grip. You don't, in the traditional grip, there was like they used to play back in the Civil War days when the drummer was marching along and he had a drum on his side and you have to hold your left hand differently in order to accommodate that slant on the drum, kind of. So your hands aren't held, it's not the same grip for each hand. One, your right hand, it's kind of like a baseball bat grip, you know, you just grip it. The left hand, the stick goes through your thumb, kind of. It's different. It's traditional, and that's a traditional grip. And Ringo Starr played the match grip. He played with both sticks the same way, which was easier and looked cooler. And that changed my drumming style. I play match grip today. I can still play traditional, but that's why I switched over, because it looks cooler playing match grip than traditional. So that changed my drumming. It's changed thousands of other drummers. A lot of drummers changed their style that night. He's very influential in the drumming world. Even though some people don't consider him a great drummer, he is. He's very, very good, very solid. And that's about why 90% of the guys today play traditional, because of Ringo Starr.
Wow, okay. Wow. That's really interesting. Not being a drummer.
Uh-huh.
I've kind of heard that he, you know, affected people, but I wasn't sure why, so now
that's
I know.
That's why. Because nobody ever played it. I mean, I never saw anybody, nobody ever saw anybody play the match grip. It was always traditional grip. And then he's playing it. You know, it kind of makes more sense to play with the match grip, both your hands the same way. And the reason they had the traditional grip, like I said, was during the wars when drummers were marching and they're carrying the drum and it's on a slant and you have to play like that, you know. And it just carried over into orchestra and other things like that. But he changed the drum history. You look and ask a lot of drummers and they'll say that's why they're playing the match grip like he plays.
Wow. Well, you know, you also said that you started questioning the church and some of the things about religion. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. I was raised Catholic, and back then, you know, I was born in 1949, and it was a wonderful time to be a kid. There was neighborhoods were safe, the schools were good, people looked out for neighbors looked out for neighborhood kids, a sense of community. It was great. But the church's teaching back then was heavily into hell and you're going to burn forever and stuff like that. And I remember one of our sisters saying, hey, have you ever burned your fingers on the stove, boys and girls? Do you know how painful that is? Well, can you imagine you're being on fire for eternity? And I was like, you know, and I had a fear of going to hell and, you know, burning forever, you know. And I mean, it's bad enough if you're going to purgatory. They used to believe in a thing called purgatory, which is, it's like you have an account with God, and you know, if every time you sin, you have to spend more time in purgatory to burn these sins off of your soul, kind of thing. And then you can go to confession and get a confess your sins and get a, it's like a start all over and you're out of jail card kind of thing, you know, where they forgive your sins and then you don't have to spend time in purgatory. But if you die with those sins on your soul, like say you commit a crime and then die before you go to confession, then you got to go to purgatory and burn off your sins, you know. That's what they were teaching back then. And that scared the hell out of me, you know, and I said, oh, you know. And I was so worried. I was such a good kid. I was so worried about going to hell and stuff like that. And I also, that's one of the reasons I thought I wanted to be a priest, because I thought, if I don't become a priest, somebody won't go to confession, and they're going to spend the rest of their life burning in hell, you know, for eternity. So I had this thing, I got to become a priest to hear confession so I could free people from going to hell. So that's how I got into the seminary. But then when I was in there and started finding out stuff that, you know, the Catholic Church had the Inquisition, you know, we used to torture people, and the Crusades, and all the bastard popes, and, you know, the popes were living like kings, and just all the bad things about the Church. And for so long I was taught that you had to believe everything the Catholic Church said, and that you know, even thinking is a sin. You know, you can commit a sin by thought, word, or deed. So just thinking about something is a sin, you know. So they have, like, mind control over you kind of thing, you know. So when I started, and then back then they believed that the host, like when they have mass, when he consecrates the host, it becomes the body, blood, soul, and divinity of God. It's not just a symbolic representation. It's actually God, you know. And when I was a kid going to church, if they somebody like dropped the host, they would come out and do make this big ceremony. They would have to clean it up with a special rag that was washed in a special sink, you know, because that contained God. It was just kind of a, I started questioning that the older I got, and I said, I don't really believe it's really God. I think it's just like a symbol, you know. But if that was enough, just questioning, it was a mortal sin. You could die and go to hell, you know. So in my college years, when I, first year when I went to Northwestern, I was a freshman, and I quit going to church then. And so now I don't believe in God so much anymore. I mean, I don't believe in the way the Catholic Church says, with a heaven and hell and going to burn for all eternity kind of thing. I believe in more like a positive spirit and a positive force. We're all one, all tied into something. But I don't think there's a God sitting up in somewhere in heaven looking down on us, you know, deciding who's going to win the Super Bowl. They played more for me. You know, people are always playing to God to win stuff or to help them, you know. I don't think there's a God up there thinking, let's see, I think they have more prayers. I'm going to go with them this year, you know. I don't think there's that kind of God, but there's some kind of force out there that we all come from. But I don't know, you know. But I just am not a Catholic anymore. But I believe in doing good for people and helping each other and loving each other and trying to be as positive a person as you can. But I don't think there's a heaven and hell.
Okay, well, I do know you're a good person from knowing you, so
oh,
I agree
you.
With that. Yeah. Well, I know you got married and you had kids, and I know you're a good family person, and but I also know that social justice issues are important to you, and I wondered if you would share with the people listening, what are some of the social justice issues that you do care about? What's important to you?
Well, it started out with the war in Vietnam back in the 60s, back when I was a hippie and stuff after I came out of the seminary, and that we shouldn't be out going around the world killing people. What were the Vietnam weren't doing anything to us, you know. It was, the 60s were a very powerful time, and I always believed in fighting for what was right, and I thought it was right, so we would demonstrate and went to Washington on the March on Washington to try and get them to end the war. So that's where I first got involved. And then I realized that there's somebody running the government that isn't the government. There's something going on that is, they're trying to make us believe certain things. Like they control the media, they control the news. And so I always thought that if you were good and positive, it would win out in the end, and that was what you should do, fight. But then when the 60s came and they assassinated JFK, Martin Luther King, Bobby Kennedy, and then the Kent State shooting, I realized there's somebody in power here, and they're not playing by the rules. And just because you're right doesn't mean you're going to win. But you have to do what you can. But then after that, I kind of, you know, after like my idealism was kind of crushed after all your heroes are murdered, and you realize that they have the power to do whatever they want. And I experienced that from Chicago police when back then I had long, when I came out of the seminary, I had long hair and a beard, and my wife and I were borrowed my roommate's car, and we were driving around, and we pull up to a stoplight, and this car next to us, there's a bunch of guys going, "Hey, sweetie, hey," you know, because they have long hair and they're making fun of me and stuff. So I flip them the finger and drive away, and it turns out they're undercover policemen. So they pull me over and get me out and threaten to beat me up, and, you know, they handcuff me, and I got arrested. And I'm in the car, and I'm saying, "Fuck you." And I was, oh, I don't know if I can say that, but I was swearing out. And they said, "Say that one more time, and we're going to throw you in the river, and they'll never find you," kind of thing, you know. And my roommate, he was from Michigan, so there were Michigan plates on. He said, "You guys from Michigan are going to learn that the Chicago cops don't take shit. You say that one more time, and you're going to wind up in the river." And I said the same thing to him, like, "Fuck you," again. And I just curled up thinking he's going to hit me, but they didn't do anything. Anyways, I went to court, and they were trying to say I was guilty of inciting a riot or something, you know. But so they can change it. That was my first real experience with, hey, that wasn't the truth. They lied and they got away with it, you know. You know, we're not playing by fair rules here. We're fighting a system that's been running the country for years, and they can do whatever they want. They have the power. So nowadays, I'm against like companies like Monsanto, who are trying to take over our food industry, and they have all their chemicals killing our bees and making pesticides that are damaging the earth. They're trying to make it so we cannot grow our own our crops anymore. You're going to have to buy your seeds from Monsanto. These GMOs, they don't reproduce, so that you have to keep buying the seeds from Monsanto if you want to be a farmer. And they're taking over the food industry in the world, you know. Plus, they're poisoning our bees, which do our pollinating, which we need for crops. And their pesticides are horrible. They're causing all these birth defects and sickness. But they've paid off the politicians. They spend millions lobbying our politicians and getting the laws passed in their favor. They're doing these experiments with GMOs that are really weird. And ex-Monsanto lawyers run the FDA. They're appointed by Obama. So you've got, like, you know, the wolf guarding the chicken coop, you know, or the hawk guarding the chicken coop, because they used to work for Monsanto, so of course they're going to pass everything that Monsanto wants and approve everything. So Monsanto is one of the most evil, nasty, horrible corporations in the world, and they've bought off all our politicians. So I'm against Monsanto. I'm against Nestle. Peggy, my wife, back when we were married, she used to boycott Nestle for their practices with infant formula in third world countries. Right. They would go in and give the mothers free breast milk, I mean, not breast milk, free baby formula for them, just right. enough, like for a month or two of free samples, so that their milk would dry up, and then they would have to buy their formula. Then it wasn't free anymore. And they were using bad water, and all these kids were dying, and Nestle was just promoting it as a healthy thing to do. If you really loved your children, you would give them formula instead of your own breast milk, and they were making money off of them. So she started boycotting Nestle a long time ago, and Nestle's an evil company too. Now they're in their water, they're taking all this water from private lands and selling it for millions of dollars, and they're only paying like $300 a year. It's crazy. So we're boycotting Nestle, and I'm kind of a guy who believes in the stuff that the conspiracy thing, 9/11, and all, and the JFK and Bobby Kennedy, all were killed by people who are running the government, the real people who are running the government, who've been running it for years, the Rockefellers and Rothschilds and Westinghouses and all those heavy duty hitters, the elite. They're the real government. It doesn't matter who our president is. These guys are actually running the show. So that's my look on politics.
Hey, Roman.
Yes.
Roman, heard you wrote a song about Monsanto.
I did.
Is there any way I could get you to sing it?
I could try.
Okay. I got
there
just enough time for it. I got about 3 minutes left.
Okay. Well, let's see. Just got back from the protest, and I'm ready to drop. Thousands of people marching, saying this has got to stop. We march to their headquarters, cop escort all the way. Thousands of people shouting, this is what they had to say. Say fuck no to Monsanto, let those banners unfurl. Say fuck no to Monsanto, they're trying to rule the world. That's the first verse. It's like four verses, but it's basically it.
Okay.
I talk about
really
how they're trying to corner the market on growing food. Their science fiction veggies are up to no damn good. Ex-Monsanto's big wigs run the FDA. Now's the time to fight back and save the day. You won't hear it on the TV. It won't be in the news. They control the media. They got too much to lose. Let's see. Who can you trust in our government? From the Bushes to Obama, they've had all the presidents. That's got some of the lyrics on it. So, you know, it doesn't sound as dynamic without a band, but
yeah.
You asked for it, so there you go.
Yeah. Roman, I want to thank you so much for speaking with us today on our Wednesday afternoon show about artists and social justice issues. I think you really fit the bill. I want to thank you for all your years of music that you've shared with the people, and thank you for being with us today. Thank you so much, Roman.
Welcome. You're welcome, Diane. It's a pleasure, and thank you for doing all you do for your community and the art world. You're great. Keep up the good work.
Thanks a lot, Roman. I'll talk to you soon.
Okay.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Bye for now. So that was Roman Zubicki, a musician, an activist, a songwriter, a family man, carpenter, a very unique person, a very good person. I've known him for some time, and very entertaining. So I want to end on another thing. I want to thank everybody for listening today, and I hope that you'll do the best that you can do to help your community and your world, and spend a little effort on the social justice issues that you believe that are very important. Goodbye for now. This is Diana Long signing off. Bye now.